When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Everybody, welcome to episode number 196 of the SoxProspects.com podcast. We are the web's number one source for information on the Boston Red Sox farm system from top to bottom, from Fort Myers to Worcester and all stops in between. Man, thank you for listening. My name is Chris Hatfield and I am the executive editor of SoxProspects.com, and I am joined as always by our director of scouting, Ian Kundle. Ian, it's mid-November. We knew it was going to be slow, but literally nothing has happened in the last 2 weeks except for what we're mainly going to be talking about today, and that's highlights from the Fall Instructional League. Always a fun episode. I think we've got some good stuff. I think folks are going to be really interested in what we've got to share with them reports-wise.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, you're not counting Drew Smyly's contract.
Oh, I meant for the Red Sox.
Oh, okay.
I meant for the Red Sox. Because I was going to say the Red Sox don't have any transactions listed on our transactions page since November the 4th.
Was that when they did all the minor league stuff?
Yep. Yeah. Actually, that's when...
No. They signed Kevin McCarthy.
Oh, well, I mean, I guess technically it hasn't gone through. And by the way, November the 4th was when Jose Peraza signed the NDFA. The minor league free agent date was November the 2nd as Tilly the dog decides to play with her loudest toy.
You're right. The Kevin McCarthy deal is not official yet.
It's not official, but it the Red Sox signed a minor league free agent. He's a pitcher. His name is Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah.
He's going to be in Worcester next year. Mm-hmm. Unless he makes a major league roster, in which case he gets like $800,000.
Yeah. But
at any rate.
In all seriousness, Drew Smyly, I honestly thought it was a $1 million contract when I first saw it.
And instead of 1 year, 11.
I was like, oh, that's fine. Like $1 million for Drew Smyly. Like he hasn't been good in like 4 years, yeah, except for last year.
The contract's weird.
And then I looked at it and I was like, oh, interesting. I don't understand this pitching market was kind of my takeaway from it. It's going to be weird.
Of course, but the dog went from her loudest toy to her second loudest toy. I apologize. Yeah, it's a weird pitching market because the two deals are Ray and Smyly.
The Ray one made sense. It was like
re-sign.
He's good. They probably overpaid him a little because they gave up something at the deadline. But I mean, Robbie Ray was a borderline all-star 2 years ago. He just can't throw strikes now. Like Drew Smyly got $3 million more, and Drew Smyly threw 26 good innings last year after not having thrown a full season since like 2015.
Right. Like, I mean, it's an upside play, but still.
Yeah. So we'll see. I know.
At any rate, we're here talking about the Red Sox, and we want to thank those who are supporting us on patreon.com/SoxProspects. You can go there to support the podcast, pledge an amount per episode, and it helps us keep this podcast going. And as always, we want to give a shout out to our $5 level Patreon supporters. That's Kyle Costigan, Tyler Woodrall, Jeff Trainer, David Nardone, Tim Harding, Bill Stanton, Evan, Deb Kendall, Evan Kirkwood, Hurricanes 1, Chris Fox, James O'Hara, Nathan Kenyon, Andrew Wallen, David B., Ben Burnett, Al Mendel, Kevin Catrides, Ben NRI, Paul Denyer, Lendl Martin, Cassandra Buchta, James P. McMahon, Stephen Gregory, and James Bailey. Thank you to all of them. And of course, as always, we want to talk about what you want to hear about. Send your emails to podcast@soxprospects.com. We've got a few emails today. We try to get to all of our emails, so get them in. We have a few that we're holding for the eventual draft retrospective episode, which will happen, I swear. But we'll get there. Send them in, podcast@soxprospects.com. Thank you to everyone who has sent in questions for this episode. Ian, I think we should start off with kind of errata from last episode, in which during the intro, one of us, I forget whom, made a comment of something to the effect of like an old Red Sox scout is back and we never followed up on it. So just really quick, what we were referring to is the fact that the Red Sox have rehired JT Watkins as a pro scout. Watkins, of course, the former catcher in the system, son of scout Danny Watkins, who served in the military after graduating from, I think, West Point, right? He went to Army.
Yeah, J.D. Watkins went to Army.
Right. Served in the military, came back, caught for about a year and a half, and then has served as a pro scout since. And famously, last year was wrapped up in the whole sign-stealing thing as the Red Sox video room guy. Red Sox brought him back. Honestly, not surprising. The feeling that I've gotten is that the general consensus was that he got kind of scapegoated a little bit.
Well, I don't think punished, by the team, though. I think that
not by the team. MLB felt like they needed to punish someone, so they punished him. And they've got this thing where they don't punish players, apparently. So they suspended him for a year. He was rehired. He's back in the fold. Can't work in the video room next year, but, I mean, he's a pro scout. They'll have him doing pro scout stuff. So just wanted to check that off. But, yeah, some of the other stuff we'll be talking about this episode, the Rule 5 deadline to protect players on the 40-man roster from selection in the Rule 5 draft is coming up this Friday. We're recording this on Tuesday night, the 17th. The deadline is Friday the 20th, I believe at 5 p.m. Ian, it's usually 5. I don't know that, though. If you know, that would be great.
I do not know.
So we're going to talk about that. Brief mention of fall winter leagues. Who's playing where so far as we know. And then we're going to get into the fall instruct stuff, guys. We've got a lot of reports. We've got a ton of intel from the nearly six-week fall instructional camp the Red Sox held down at Fort Myers. Got cut off a little early because of the tropical storm that was coming into Fort Myers. But we've got all kinds of intel from down there, so we're going to go through that. But, Ian, let's maybe start with Rule 5 deadline. That's the next pending date coming up on the calendar. And we've talked about it a little bit, but I think in part because of the reports we've gotten from instructs, and in part because we just want to kind of put a bow on it before Friday comes, we wanted to just go through. And I think what we did for the listeners is that Ian and I, without telling each other, came up with our rankings of who we thought the Red Sox would protect on Friday and how likely, from most to least likely, to be protected those players were to be protected. I think, Ian, we both came up with the same number of players, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the same number of players, and we can mention guys who we don't think are going to make it that we, you know, are kind of, you know, I get not potential, but just we've mentioned guys who might.
Yeah.
So I guess we don't really need to go too far into it. But at any rate, we ranked them, and we're going to go through them for your listening enjoyment. So I think we might as well get started, Ian. Let's get number one out of the way. 100% certainty they're going to protect Brian Mata. I think we agree.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty simple. No reason to really belabor the point. Do you want to just go back and forth? Like, you do two out of three, you do four?
Sure.
And we'll talk about who we had there instead if we disagree?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're up for number two.
I had Connor Siebold as number two, and yep. It wasn't really close. They're obviously going to protect him. He's a close 100%. To big league ready, you know, back end starter potentially.
It's proximity is the thing. I mean, if he's unprotected, there's no question he gets picked probably 1-1.
Yeah.
To me, this is where, like, 1 and 2 were easy. I think we agreed on that, and then I think 3 to 7 was where it got kind of tough to figure out. Number three, I actually went with Connor Wong.
I did as well.
Did you? Okay.
Yep.
To me, it was a combination of catcher and proximity.
Yep. I actually, that was not even I didn't consider anyone else for there.
Really?
I think that 1 and 2 were pretty set, and 3 was set for me also.
Yeah, I think that all three of those are 100% certainty, and I think those are the only three guys I would say 100% certainty.
I agree.
Yep. Okay. Who did you have at number four? And before you say who it is, give me your percentage of how likely you think it is he's protected. Not that it really means anything.
Number four for me was Jay Groom.
Okay.
I personally
me too.
Would have me him too. There, but I think he's there in terms of percentage-wise, and I think that there's like a 95% chance he's protected.
Would only put it about 75%.
I don't see it. Like, he's going to get picked. Someone's going to take the chance if he doesn't get protected, but maybe 95 is a little high. I was going to maybe 80, but I think.
Yeah. I think 80, 75 to 80 feels right for me.
Yeah.
Because there's the, you know, the fact he hasn't pitched, like, can you stash Jay Groom? Right. You know what I mean? Like, I guess you could pitch him out of the bullpen.
Well, this is the thing. I think he could get lefties out. Like, even we'll talk about it in a little bit, but he wasn't very good at instructs. And even then, though, from the guys I was talking to, they all said he still can get lefties out, even though his curveball and fastball have regressed. So, because he's got some deception, he's got that big over the top deliver or big frame. Like, it's still tough on lefties. And I think you could probably hide him in a lefty specialist role, especially since it's not clear if MLB is going to keep the three batter minimum. Like, that's not a guarantee yet.
Right.
So, especially if they go back to like allowing, you know, loogies, then I think a team could stash him in that role for a year.
Or the 26 man roster too now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, for now it could even be more. Who knows? Given what COVID is doing.
Right. True. All right. Cool. The number five guy I had, and this is I'm actually kind of wondering if we had the same list. This will be really interesting. The number five guy I had. It's interesting to me that he's five, because a month ago I didn't have him on the list, and that's Edward Bizzardo. And it looks, looking at you, it looks like we differ. Or do we not?
No, I had him at five originally, and then I changed my mind.
Interesting. Okay, the reason
I have him at five, I did it in terms of the way I think that the Red Sox will think about it.
Well, and that's kind of what I did too. I just think, and we're going to talk more about this in a bit, and I mean, maybe we should just get into it. The way Bizzardo looked at the fall instructional league camp, whatever you want to call it, I don't think there's any chance he goes unpicked.
Yeah.
I think he's the prototypical Rule 5 pick.
Yeah, he really is. Like, every year these guys go in the top, like, 5 to 10.
And, you know, I thought there was a chance that the Red Sox will go into the Rule 5 draft with at least one roster spot open so they can pick someone. And we talked about this in the last episode. It's going to be either – it would be either a reliever or a bench bat, right? Mm. Why leave a spot open on your 40-man and leave Bizzardo unprotected to get picked when you can have a player that you – when you're going to select a player that you can't option who may or may not be much better than Bizzardo?
Yeah, that's the thing to me is, like, Bizzardo – as I've tweeted about it, so it's not exactly breaking news, but he was the most impressive pitcher at camp in terms of just his stuff tick up Rough compared stuff. To what he was before. And yeah, I mean, you have a 25-year-old who he's had success in double A. Like, he was very, I thought he should have been protected last year, and I stand by that. And I was surprised when he went undrafted last year, but right. I guess, you know, the thinking was there were probably pitchers with more upper level minors experience and who had better stuff. Cause last year, yeah, his curveball was good, but his fastball was just like fringy. It was fine. Like, it wasn't a standout fastball or anything. And because of what it is now, it's obviously much better than that. I think he has to be protected, and I don't see why you wouldn't. Like, the Red Sox, they showed this year that they churn and burn with relievers. They're looking for guys, and his stuff right now is better than a lot of the guys they have on that in the who they pitched in the back of that bullpen this year. Like, we're talking about a guy who could have, you know, two plus to better pitches. And his curveball's got options. That elite spin rate. He's optionable. He's team controlled for what,
six or seven, depending on how often, like, how long you have him up.
Yeah. I just don't. Yeah, I agree with you. I did have a different person here though, just because the fact that they didn't protect him last year is still weird to me. And
Bizzardo. Yeah. Well, it's because his stuff. To me, the stuff was so much better based on the reports we got from the Fall Instructional League. It's almost like he's a different player. If it was the same stuff, I would not have him on the list.
Yeah, so I had him five, and then at the last minute, I did change him.
Okay, who do you have a five instead?
I put Hudson Potts at five.
Okay, interesting.
And I think these three guys at the bottom are all pretty interchangeable. And I did actually have Bizzardo first, and then I changed it at the last minute. My thinking on Potts is that they clearly liked him. He's got power. You know, he's young. He's still super young. Like, he's, you know, 3 years younger than Bizzardo. He's played third base, maybe a little first base and second base. He was obviously pushed aggressively by the Padres, but he's the type of guy that I think a team could hide in like a bench bat role, just a pinch hitter to face lefties, you know, just come in. And I think that in terms of like upside, he has more upside than Bizzardo, because Bizzardo, like, best case is, you know, maybe an eighth inning reliever. Whereas Potts, I mean, I don't know if this is, I wouldn't project him as this, but, you know, you can dream maybe he develops into like a number six hitter, number seven hitter for a team, you know, like a fringy everyday guy.
Right.
And that's worth more to me than a reliever. So I had him ahead.
What percentage would you put would you put on them protecting Potts?
I think like 75.
That high. Okay. I would probably. So I had Potts last and I already hated it. I already will switch him with Rosario. For Potts, I would put it maybe it's, what did you say?
I think Bizzardo and Potts are both like 75%.
Okay. I would put Potts at like 70, maybe a smidge below Bizzardo. Bizzardo, I would put it like 75 now. And Potts, I might put it like 70.
Yeah.
And that's like splitting hairs at that point. But
yeah
I have Potts last, but I already want to change it to have him sixth.
Yeah, my last wasn't actually close. I was pretty,
really,
I felt pretty good about who I
was
playing.
And the reason being is Jason Rosario. It's how far away he is.
Yeah, he's farther away, and he just doesn't have the profile of a guy you can stash, really, because he's not a burner. Like, he's probably more of like an average runner than a plus runner. It's fine defense, you know, it's above average defense, but that's about it. You know, I don't think he can hit. He's got no power. Like, he couldn't hit major league pitching, what I mean, right now. And he's got no power. So he's just a tough guy to carry on your bench. And he's never played above high A. So
yeah,
I just think his proximity is a case for him not getting added. But then, you know, you look at, you can also say the same thing about last year when they added Marcus Wilson. Like, Wilson, what, he was demoted from double A to high A last year and still got added.
Yeah, but then he came up. Like, because when they sent him to high A, he worked with Lance, whose last name I need to learn to pronounce.
It's like it's a Z, Brzezinski. Doesn't it?
Yeah. It's like Brzezinski.
Or it has, I really need to learn to pronounce
that name. Yeah, but this is a Z. They sent him down. He fixed him, and he went back up to double A and was a much better hitter.
But yeah, but like he only.
But
had...
like it's the better comp is Yoan Ibar, probably, because he was a reliever.
Yeah, but I was trying to think the same position though.
Right.
But yeah,
right. Fair.
I think he's the least likely. I still think he probably gets added, but I think it's like closer to like 55 or 64. Like, it's closer to 50-50.
Yeah, I think 55 or 60% that he gets added sounds right.
Yeah.
And I think it's those seven. I don't really think there's anyone else they wind up considering.
No, I mean, like, so, the only other person people like maybe is like someone like Pedro Castellanos or something, but
I can't see it. It's a bad profile.
I don't see it.
Yeah. If Josh Ockamy didn't get picked either of the last 2 years, Pedro Castellanos.
Well, that's the thing, is like power only corner bats just don't have as much value. And I think that is, I guess you could make the case for against Potts, but Potts at least plays third base, whereas Castellanos and Ockamy were first base only, which is a little different.
And I wouldn't even call Castellanos a power only guy.
Yeah. So
he's hit for power for exactly half a season of his career.
That's fair, or less than that, but yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So we'll see. We've got seven now. You know, the rise of Bizzardo has been interesting. If they leave, I mean, let's put it this way, because the other piece of this, right, is the 40-man roster is at 36 right now.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to add seven, the Red Sox would need to clear at least three spots. But when you look at the roster, I mean, I see names on there like Marcus Walden, Colton Brewer, Ryan Weber, Kyle Hart.
Jeffrey Springs.
I'm just going down the list. But yeah, Jeffrey Springs, Matt Hall, Austin Bryce, Robert Stock. You know, there are plenty of guys. Never mind. I don't think it's going to happen yet, but at some point, Dustin Pedroia is going to be, you know, reach an agreement with the team, I'm sure. That would lead to his release. But, you know, I think you just wait to do that later in the year, because you're going to need roster spots later to sign major league free agents or to make trades or something. So I don't think you really need to do that yet.
Well, and I think another thing that for me is that if you look at the Red Sox current situation, they're not in the position to like leave good players unprotected. You know, they can't lose this farm system depth. And that's why, like, I just would be surprised if any of these seven guys got unprotected. It's not like they have a 40-man roster crunch or anything. They need these prospects in the system. It would just be very strange to me and very unlike something I would expect the Rays or Chaim Bloom to do.
And I mean, part of the reason, Ian, I don't think I really made this clear to you when we were talking about the show, but part of the reason I was just wondering whether we should talk about the non-tender deadline is that the Red Sox have non-tender candidates, mostly in the bullpen. Austin Bryce is arbitration eligible. He has no options left. He's a non-tender candidate. You could look at a, let's see, who else is ARB eligible? Ryan Brazier, depending on what the money is a non-tender candidate. Matt Barnes, frankly, is a non-tender candidate. You know, the projection MLB Trade Rumors, I think, has him making like $5 million or something like that. If you think you can bring him back for two, you non-tender him. You know, or if you just want to pay someone else that money. So there are a number of non-tender candidates who could be there. You know, it'll be, you know, do you outright a guy now instead of waiting till the non-tender deadline? Who knows? But they've got the space to add all seven guys and have space when the Rule 5 draft rolls around.
Exactly. And the thing is, too, with regards to, you know, going forward, realistically, the only ones who are farish away, I mean, Rosario and Groom are definitely not close, but at least the rest of them are all in the high minors. And with guys like, I could see Mata, Siebold, Bizardo making their debuts next year, maybe even Wong. So it's not like they're adding a bunch of like high A guys. Like,
yeah,
three, four of those guys could potentially be up at some point next season.
Yeah. So I think.
So my point is, they're not going to be like wasting seven spots on guys we won't see next year.
No. I think a few of those guys are close, because I remember like Tanner Houck was in this list too, and then they just happened to call him up this year.
Exactly.
So yeah, there's room for these guys if they want to make it. All right, moving along, we want to mention fall and winter leagues are already going. If not already started, there is no Arizona Fall League, which is usually the marquee off-season league. You know, the top players from the team. It's more of an official MLB joint, basically. But the international winter leagues have started. Some started just this past weekend, which is why I wanted to mention it. But some, I didn't realize this, Ian. The Mexican Pacific League has been going since October 15th, apparently. Yeah, it's been going for more than a month. Probably because I think because in Mexico they have a winter league that's called the Mexican Pacific League, and then there's this summer league, which is just the Mexican League. I don't think they had a summer league this year, so they started the winter league early. Joey Meneses, who was a re-signed minor league free agent, has already like 77 at bats. He's hitting .299, playing mostly third base, which is kind of interesting because he hadn't really played third base before this year. Like only, I think, a handful of games. So you wonder if that's something where the Red Sox said, hey, you know, learning third base would be a good thing for you to do if you want to go try that. So that's kind of interesting. Also playing in Mexico, Ian, Marcus Wilson. He's only played in one game, but Marcus Wilson is playing for Mexicali. He went over. But, yeah, interesting. It kind of, you know, makes it a little less of an issue that he didn't go to the Fall Instructional League, which he couldn't because he was on the 40. But interesting that he's down in Mexico. Other leagues that started this past week, the Nicaraguan National Professional Baseball League started, and the Red Sox have two guys down there, native Nicaraguans, Nixon Munoz and Roniel Raudes. Both of them made their debuts, and both of them got lit up, so we won't go too much into it. But Raudes, of course, coming off missing a year in 2019 because of injury, and then, of course, in 2020 because there was no season. He, you know, you may remember, was one of the younger players moving up through the system. He's pitched in high A, repeated it, kind of hit a wall a little bit there. So we'll see if there's anything there coming back. Nixon Munoz is a guy who had pitched in the DSL in 2019. And, of course, this past year got injured. Or no, this past year didn't happen. Sorry. The Dominican League also got started this past weekend. Playing there so far are pitchers Raynel Espinal, who the Red Sox drafted in the minor league Rule 5 from the New York Yankees. He's pitching out of the bullpen for Los Gigantes del Chibao. And right-hander Denny Reyes is a starter for Leones del Escogido. So he's starting down there. And on the hitting side, catcher Davy Grillon is playing for Las Aguilas, the Eagles. And in his first game, he went deep. And apparently, I didn't realize this, Ian, Grillon's nickname... I need the Spanish for it. Hang on, because it's better in the Spanish. If you know the word, please go ahead. Where is it?
It's El Pulpo. Okay.
El Pulpo,
yeah.
Which is the octopus.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Love it. David Grillon went yard in game one, and in the Aguilas tweet talked about his, called him El Pulpo. Pulpo, P-U-L-P-O. Which means the octopus, and I'm not referring to him as any other thing going forward. So, yeah, they're playing in the Dominican. And some leagues that haven't gotten started yet, in Panama, Jonathan Aruz is going to be teaming with DSL outfielder Eduardo Vaughn on Las Aguilas Metropolitanas. Red Sox are going to have a few guys in Puerto Rico. We don't know the full list yet, but one of them will be Jaron Duran, who will be playing outfield for Caguas, which is coached by Red Sox. He's still a coach for them, Ramon Vasquez, Red Sox Major League coach. Ramon Vasquez is the manager down there, so he'll be playing for him. Should be a few other guys down there. And then outfielder Colin Willis, who has yet to play for the Red Sox yet because there was no season this past year, will return to Melbourne, where last year he was like one of the best hitters in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have more as more guys are announced. We don't know if anyone's playing in Colombia or Venezuela. Frankly, it's frustrating because there's just like very little information until the season starts. Like in the Dominican, they don't announce rosters until like the day of the game. So there were no rosters until like opening day. So I don't even know when the Venezuelan season is going to start at this point. It's a little annoying. But at any rate, keep an eye on our news page. We're going to have fall winter league recaps that are going to be starting up hopefully next week. So keep your eyes to our news page. That's news.soxprospects.com. All right, Ian, do we want to get to the main event?
Sure.
Let's do it. Fall Instructional League this year was about 5.5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Red Sox invited, what was it, 60 guys?
62.
62 guys down to Fort Myers for camp. And what we're going to do, we're going to go over highlights. We're going to go over lowlights. We're going to do a couple other groups of newer players, international guys who we hadn't really gotten reports on yet, and the draftees and non-drafted free agents who just entered the system. But first, Ian, it might make sense to give context to that, to this. Well, let's talk about what was the structure like of the Fall Instructional League for those who maybe didn't listen to us talk about it before and who are unfamiliar with the Fall Instructional League. What's the typical day like? Because you and I have both been down there.
So
I presume it was about the same.
A typical day in Fall Instructs is in the morning the players work out on the backfields, do, you know, infield, outfield, positional drills, BP. And then around noon, 1 o'clock, they head over to the park and they play what it used to be against other teams in 9-inning games. But that's kind of changed the last few years. And last year, they just played like inter-squad scrimmages or simulated games. And this year, they did a little bit of both. Originally, they were only planning on doing inter-squad games, but they left it open to add games on the schedule. And they ended up adding 2 games against Tampa Bay's fall instructional team. So they played a pair of games against Tampa and then a bunch of inter-squad games that ranged in length from, you know, 3 innings to 9 innings, depending on how many pitchers they had to throw, how long innings were taking, you know, if pitchers hit their inning, their pitch limit. And these games, they had umpires and everything, so they were pretty formal, but they did still allow, you know, the typical rolling innings if a pitcher hit his pitch cap. Or if he, you know, got through an inning too quickly, they might throw a fourth batter out there just to get some work in. But, and of course, yeah, they could hit like 2 DHs. Like the lineups were very varied if they wanted to. But, it's good. From what I mean, obviously, we could not attend, but, Red Sox.
Nor would we have, frankly.
No, the Red Sox did allow, they agreed to be part of the scout program where, other teams were allowed to scout their camp if they were allowed to scout other teams' camp if they opened their camp up to other scouts, and the Red Sox did that. So luckily we were able to still get reports on it, and some interesting stuff went on down there.
Yeah, and I guess for context, Ian, especially given who's on the list, we should start with, and I've got the list pulled up, the list of players who were on the roster, which we've already talked about, but did not play.
Well, this is the thing. They did not play in games that scouts were allowed to watch. That doesn't necessarily mean they didn't play, because there was going on backfields during the games that the scouts weren't allowed to go to, or scouts or evaluators from other teams weren't allowed to go to. So it's unclear what went on back there, but
true.
If it was games or workouts or what, but they did not play in the inner squads or against the Rays. These 13 players, I believe you're about to read off.
Yep. And I mean, I'll just probably start by going through the most noteworthy guys. The most noteworthy one is Brian Mata didn't pitch down there, which makes some sense, Ian, given that he got a lot of work in at the alternate training site. All other alternate training site guys who didn't play were Hudson Potts and Connor Wong, who are both Rule 5 eligible. Oh, I just feel like, okay. They're both Rule 5 eligible as well. They didn't play. Not to say that Rule 5 eligible guys didn't play, because obviously Pizarro did, but they both gotten work in at the alternate training site and didn't play down there. Although Jason Rosario did play. He did play, so we'll talk about him in a minute. Other players who didn't play down there, not surprising that Cutter Crawford didn't. He's coming off of Tommy John. We knew he would still be rehabbing. Chase Shugart, who pitched for Greenville last year, didn't pitch down there. The newly acquired Jacob Wallace, the return from the Colorado Rockies in exchange for Kevin Pillar, didn't play or didn't pitch. Ryan Zephyrjohn, the third-round pick in 2019, didn't pitch at all in games. Thad Ward, who I basically skipped over, probably the guy we were most looking forward to maybe getting some new reports on, given that he's a top 10 guy and was not at the alternate. I would say best player that wasn't at the alternate training site, that wasn't just like too young for it. He didn't pitch at all, so that was a little bit disappointing. So no reports on him. Other pitchers, Jacinto Arredondo, he's a reliever the Red Sox signed as a non-drafted free agent, has a little cool sort of Carter Capps hop step, didn't pitch. Jorge Rodriguez, Mexican pitcher who we've heard some good reports on. He's currently in our top 30, I think, Ian. He didn't pitch. I said Shugart, Wallace, Ward, Zephyrjohn. Pedro Castellanos, first baseman, did not play in games, which was very interesting because they were kind of thin on first baseman down there. And then a couple of catchers in Cole Cottom, who my guess would be that Cottom played in the Battle of the Bourbon Trail put on by the Lexington Legends. And I forget the up-the-road team that they organized that with. But he got plenty of catching in over the summer, I think was the thinking there. And then Alex Arrow, a 2019 draft pick, who is learning catcher, did not play at all, which makes sense because he's learning a completely new position. So that was the list of guys who did not play. And let's get into the guys who did play. And I guess we could start with some highlights. Who were the top couple of guys that you got reports on from Instructs? Some of them are pretty familiar, going to be pretty familiar names to folks.
So actually it was interesting because there was a consensus top three from everyone I talked to, and they all had the same three guys. And that was the top overall player was Gilberto Jimenez. The number second was Tristan Casas, and third was Aldo Ramirez. So it was kind of interesting that everyone kind of came up with the same list. I guess we'll start with Jimenez since he was the first. Obviously, you know, we've been very bullish on Jimenez since we first saw him. And I think the most important thing is that he's finally like put weight on and is actually starting to drive the ball. You know, if you look at his numbers last year, he has like a 70% ground ball rate, and he really was just trying to slap the ball and play and run. Mm-hmm. And that was all he was doing in Lowell. And obviously he did it to great success. You know, I think he led the Penn League in hitting, hit what, 370 or something along those lines. But the approach was really raw last year. You know, he put the ball in play, but it was a lot of weak contact and kind of just beating it out because he was an 80 runner. And things have definitely changed there. And, you know, now last year I looked back at Lowell and he was listed at 5'11", 160 pounds. Now on the Instructs roster, he was listed at 5'11", 212 pounds.
And to be fair, that doesn't mean he was 160
something. No, he definitely wasn't 160.
That's what he was when he signed. But still, that's not too far off.
He definitely was not 160 pounds last year. I would guess he's probably 180. But he's put on significant muscle. And it's really making a difference because, you know, he's someone who he did not have a lot of power last year. His home runs were more kind of like dinks over the wall. And I think he had an inside the park home run also. And most of his doubles, it just, he didn't square the ball up a lot. And now, he's hitting home runs, especially right-handed. He's starting to actually swing the bat with a purpose. You know, he's not going up there looking to just slap the ball and put it in play. And that's exactly what he needs to do developmentally. You know, he's someone that is an insane athlete. I don't know if he's an 80 runner anymore. Guys I talked to there said he's more like a 70 runner now. Maybe a 75.
Makes sense.
But he lost a little speed, but I'm gladly take the trade off of like 20 pounds of muscle for, you know, a grade off your speed. Cause once you get above like 65, it doesn't really matter. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I actually have the numbers here, that we got like 395 to 405 hitting lefty to first base and 412 to 415 hitting righty. The right-handed numbers are more like a 70. the left-handed numbers are like a 75-70.
Yeah, so he's like
they're
a 70.
Not 80 numbers anymore.
No. So he might have lost a little speed, but he's still the same athlete he was. And, you know, I'm going to take that trade-off if right now he's showing, like, above average to plus raw power, especially from the right side of the plate. Right. And that's a massive trade-off for him. And obviously that's not game power yet. We got to be clear. But, you know, the fact that he's even got that potential is huge. And especially if he can learn to tap into that and improve, make enough contact, you know, that's a legit player. His swing is still much better from the right side of the plate, which is no surprise. He's a natural right-handed hitter, and he's one of those things that I know the numbers might not say that, whatever, but he's a much better hitter right-handed than left-handed. But his left-handed swing is now at least is serviceable. You know, it doesn't look like it used to, which was, yeah, as I said, very slap happy. He didn't use his lower half really. He was just throw his hands at the ball and try to get on base. He's actually tweaked his stance a little bit. He's opened it up and he's a little crouched and he's loading and actually trying to incorporate his lower half into the swing, which is really good to see. Long term, I still think he's going to end up having platoon splits to the point where he'll be a better right-handed hitter than left-handed hitter. But still, it was just a very encouraging performance from him, and his upside is probably the highest in the system, I would say, other than him and Casas are the two. But yeah, he's someone who everyone who saw him came away very impressed.
Yeah, probably not too much more to add to Casas from what we've already talked about, Ian. It's that he's the same guy. He can maybe a little bit of concern about the hit tool.
Yeah,
but it's impact raw. It's impact game power even.
Yeah, he's going to get on base at a huge clip. He's going to hit a ton of home runs. He's a good first baseman. He didn't play any third base at Instructs, which I think is still interesting considering he did moonlight a little bit there at the alt site, the alternate site. But yeah, I think the one question is just when it comes to hit tool, he can get a little passive, and the result, and we kind of saw it at the alternate site, is he takes a lot of pitches, and as a result, he's going to miss some swingable, he's going to miss some hittable pitches, and he's going to always have swing and miss in his game. So the hit tool, the kind of the takeaways on the hit tool from people I talked to, the range varied a little bit. You know, some see him potentially as an above average, maybe even a plus hitter, while others are more on like the fringe average to below average size. But they all agree he's still going to be an impact, that he has a chance to be an impact player because he's going to get on base at a huge clip, even if he hits 250, and he's going to hit 30 plus home runs.
And then on the pitching side, let's talk about Aldo Ramirez. And because we've already, did we give the full Bizardo report? I can't even remember. But it might be a good time to talk about the full Edward Bizardo report.
Yeah, we talked about Bizardo a little bit. So
we did. Okay.
But yeah, it's just with Bizardo, he wasn't the top pitcher because he's, at the end of the day, he's a reliever, and you can take starting pitchers over relievers.
It wasn't best in show.
But
if we're
going to talk about impressive, he was the most impressive pitcher,
right.
But he wasn't the top pitching prospect there, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just on Bizardo quickly, it's just the fastball curveball, elite spin rate on the curveball. Fastball is now 93 to 97, whereas it was 91 to 95 last year.
Which is the biggest difference for me.
Yeah, and it was mostly 95, 96.
Yeah.
And the curveball is, one scout described it to me as silly, quote unquote.
If you look at the video he posted, I mean, clearly the team gave the pitchers video of their best pitches from the camp.
Yeah.
And a bunch of them posted it to their social media, which was great because it was like free scouting.
Yeah. And it just it confirmed what we'd heard, which was also nice.
Right. But it's just like with Bizardo, the good curveballs are.
They're disgusting.
Gross.
Yeah, like it's like 30, gross. 50 RPMs. Like
he'll be on Pitching Ninja, like with those curveballs.
It's like a 60, 65 fastball, 60 curveball. He can command the curveball, throws it a ton. It's the fringy, like the splitter's like below average fringy, but it's in a different velocity band and it has different shape. It's more that vertical drop, whereas his curveball can get a little two-plane break. So it just gives him another look, which is always good. So yeah, he's interesting. And then Aldo Ramirez is someone I've been kind of higher on, and I think we've been higher on than the rest of the industry has. Well, maybe not other scouts, but like the prospect covering industry. And he's someone who went out on Lowell last year and was very, very good as an 18-year-old. You know, he throws a ton of strikes. Stuff, his velocity was solid. You know, he's like low 90s last year. Good changeup. Fringy curveball, maybe average curveball. And this year, I think the thing is, it's just – he's just continued to take that step forward. You know, his velocity again, it's now like, you know, 92 to 95, 93 to 95. So a little tick up in the velocity, but he has good control of it. There's a ton of strikes. His changeup is a legit weapon. It's a very good changeup. It's plus potential pitch and maybe even more than that. Gets a lot of ground balls with it, a lot of weak contact. Hitters had a ton of trouble with it. And, you know, he actually is curveball also another pitch that I would say is like a potential average pitch. So you're talking about a guy with three potential average pitches and two of them plus. That's really interesting, especially as a 19-year-old with advanced feel who has a very good chance to remain a starter. And I think that was the biggest thing was, you know, the Red Sox have a lot of pitchers there who might be starters. They might not be. He's someone who everyone I talked to was pretty confident he could stick in the rotation. And so while it might not be his highest ceiling, it's still someone who, you know, you could dream on being like a number four starter, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, Ramirez, so like entering the year, we had him 14th, and that was the highest of anyone. The only one that was close is Alex Speer over at Baseball America. Had him 16th on his list, but I think he's going to be even higher than that on our next list, Ian, based on kind of the early returns, which, by the way, we should mention new rankings are probably coming next week.
Yep.
The week of Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of Thanksgiving reading for you while you lay down on the couch to try and digest that turkey. Or if you're, in my case, the butternut squash lasagna. I miss turkey so much.
Oh, why don't you just have a tofurkey or something?
Nah, screw that. Tofurkey sucks.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, looking at where we have him ranked, he's definitely going to be even higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, an interesting player. And that's kind of the top guys. Some other guys who are interesting, Ian, that I wanted to make sure we talked about. One guy, probably the guy on the short list of people who we really had wanted to see this spring, at the top of the list for me was Brainer Bonacci. Now we've got a significant amount of reports on him from this camp, and you know we've heard some reports as well before that, based on last year reading about the public ones, I should say. It seems like an interesting player, and I'm still very intrigued to see him in person myself.
Yeah, he was probably the top Latin player there in terms of guys who hadn't made it out of the GCL. Did he get a cup of coffee in Lowell last year? I don't think so, right?
No, he was in the DSL the whole year.
Oh, okay. He didn't even make the GCL. So, yeah, he was the top of the Latin guys who came over from the DSL or got that moonlight in the GCL at the end of the year. And he's someone who – no.
No, he didn't play in the GCL. He was in the DSL.
No, I said he didn't. I was talking about all the guys, the Latin guys who played in the DSL or GCL.
Okay, fair.
That's what I was saying.
Oh, you're saying from in the camp who had – okay.
Yes.
Sorry, thank you.
But yeah, he's someone who I don't know if it's that high a ceiling because he is very small. Like he's listed at, I think, 5'9".
I'll get it.
5'10", 164. I'll just say that height looks a little generous. If you've seen I've seen some video of him hitting. And but he's just someone who he knows how to play the game. He's a good athlete. He has some bat speed, good bat control. He's going to make contact. It's not, you know, it's like a 40 run, 40 power, but he does everything else well. You know, you can dream on average hit, average glove. He's got a plus arm for sure. And I think he's someone who can stick at shortstop. So, yeah, it's just he's the type of guy that you want to have in the lower part of your system with, and he's got some upside potential. And he was really good at the beginning, 5'10", kind of tailed off a little bit at the end, which is understandable. He's not. I don't think he's 5'10". But he's someone who I think if we had gotten a look at him, might have rose earlier. It was just kind of the situation where this is the first time we're kind of getting consistent reports on him. And but yeah, he's a really interesting guy. It's just there's instincts, there's some physical ability, some athleticism, and definitely upside. So he's an interesting guy to watch going forward.
Yeah, he was a guy that where he was. I mean, right now he's number 23 on our rankings, and that's literally throwing a dart at the dartboard. Like, we knew he needed to move up from where we had him. We just didn't really know precisely where to put him. Let's table Nick York and do all the draftees at once, Ian, and move on to a couple. If you want to just do kind of lightning round on a few more guys in the positive category of Chris Murphy, Nick Decker, Brian Baio.
So Chris Murphy is someone we obviously really liked coming out of Lowell last year. He was excellent in Lowell. You know, they made a few tweaks with his mechanics, and the end result was that he threw a ton of strikes, which he wasn't really doing in college. Still missed bats, and you know, he's not. I don't think there's a high ceiling or anything, but he just knows how to pitch. He's someone, you know, he'll pitch in the low 90s. He can run up to 96. Slider, changeup, curveball. So he's got that three pitch mix, and it's a bunch of, you know, average-ish pitches. And from the left side with four pitches that are average-ish, you know, and you throw enough strikes, that's the kind of guy who can make it pretty far in baseball these days. And so, yeah, he was like, it wasn't, you know, he wasn't like a standout. His stuff isn't going to blow you away, but he's fine. And he's professional. He's going to go out there and do the job. And that was kind of, I think, what scouts liked about him.
Yeah. I mean, and like on the fastball velocity, like this isn't Brian Johnson throwing, you know, 89 to 92.
No.
Either. He's like, I mean, from the video he posted, it was 92, 96. I'm sure it's at the lower end of that for the most part. But
yeah, he was
topping out at 96 is something that Johnson never did, right?
He was like 90 to 93 mostly. But
yeah.
Yeah. So like 90 to 96 in that range. But yeah, when you have that kind of four pitch mix, some feel, you're throwing strikes. I think the one thing is that's going to determine his upside, obviously, is the command and control gains that he showed last year in Lowell real. And he was pretty good with it in instructs. And if that continues, then that's going to go a long way to kind of like fixing any concerns people have about that the command and control was just a small sample size.
Right. Let's go with another pitcher in Brian Baio. Spent last year in Greenville. Well, he wasn't extremely young, but he made the jump straight from the, was he in the GCL? I think he was in the GCL.
Yeah, Baio is really interesting. He's got big raw stuff, like way more than Aldo, but he just doesn't have that feel that Aldo has. And I think Aldo has a much better chance to remain a starter. I'm not sure Baio is a starting pitcher long term, but he could be a really good reliever. And, you know, he's someone who was 94 to 98 miles an hour with his fastball, can miss bats with it. He's got a good, his best off speed pitch is a changeup, which is a good pitch. You know, it's mid 80s. And so the fastball changeup combination is enough that he could be a really good reliever. It's just going to, the skip thing scout said to me is it's going to depend on what happens with his slider. It didn't really make much progress from last season based on when I say last season, I mean, 2019,
right. Yeah.
Because I know a couple scouts who saw him then and then saw him again this year, and they said it hadn't made that much progress, but he also was working on it a ton. I guess he was, that was kind of what he was focusing on in some of his outings there, which makes sense, obviously, because if you got the fastball and the changeup, then you got to do that. But, you know, he's got a fastball changeup. If you can throw strikes and you're throwing in the mid to high 90s, and that could even tick up more as a start in a relief role, that's definitely a reliever at worst. But there's still a chance he can be a starter because he's so young. You know, I think he's only, what, 20 years old?
No, he's actually going to be 22 next year.
Oh, really?
He's actually pretty old. Yeah, because that's the thing. He jumped straight late from the DSL to Greenville, but he was 19 in the DSL.
That's what it was, because he signed late, right?
Because he signed late, yeah. He didn't sign until 2017, and he was already 18.
That's what throws me off.
Right.
But anyway.
He seems like he should be younger, but he's not.
But yeah, okay. But he's got that fastball and the changeup, and he's still inexperienced. So if he can improve that slider, which then, you know, you're looking at someone who potentially could be like a back-end starter. But for now, it's probably more of a relief mix.
Right. And the hitter, going back to another Lowell guy for you, Nick Decker.
Decker was, I think, of the Lowell hitters from last year. He was someone who impressed scouts there. And it was kind of more of what we saw from Lowell. He can really hit right-handed pitching. He's got big power. He can drive the ball with a ton of backspin. You know, he's got a pretty good swing. Just the problem is there's a lot of swing and miss, and he's really, really bad against lefties.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is, you know, if he could only face righties, he's super interesting, but he can't. He's going to have to face lefties, and that's the thing he's really going to have to work on, because I think it was last season he struck out, like 2019, he struck out 45% of the time against lefties. And I guess kind of going from instructs was the takeaway was he can't hit lefties at all, but he can rake against righties. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of more the same with what we heard, but it's just encouraging that he's still handling right-handed pitching even after this layoff.
Yeah. Yeah. So a set of players who showed well, let's maybe move on into, you know, players who showed they have a little bit more to work on or might've been a little bit disappointing. To me, based on the reports we got, I'd put Jay Groom at the top of that list. We already alluded to it. After kind of an encouraging stint in the alternate training site.
Yeah, he seemed like he was pretty good on video, but this is the thing. We don't have the actual velos. We're not seeing, you know, everything going on.
And part of it, I mean, you know, listening to Paul Abbott talk about him, you know, midseason, he needs to learn how to throw a bullpen and give effort in the bullpen. And then at the end of the year, he was really talking very positively about him. And Paul Abbott and Billy McMillan were, you know, they weren't saying a guy stinks, but they weren't giving effusive praise if it wasn't earned, it seemed. Like they were being, you know, realistic. And Abbott had really good things to say about Groom, but man, the reports we got on Groom from Vol Instructs were very disappointing. I'm just going to put that right out there.
Yeah, I think the biggest concern to me is that his physical condition seems to have regressed. You know, he showed up when he came back from Tommy John in excellent shape. And he
so that was in the fall of 20, not the fall, but at the tail end like of late the 2019 season.
And then in Instructs, or sorry, the alternate site this year, you could tell it seemed like he'd put on a little weight.
Yeah, you could tell he was back to not the poor. So when Groom first reported for his first full season, we heard that the Red Sox were not thrilled with the shape he was in. And that's the year that he had the lat injury.
Yeah.
That cost him most of the beginning of the season.
Was it 2017 in Greenville?
I think. And that offseason was the offseason that he worked out during the offseason with Chris Sale.
Yeah, and then he got hurt.
2018 came in better shape. Still, you know, a little soft, but that's when he had Tommy John.
Yeah.
Missed all of 18 and most of 19. But when he came back in 19, I mean, I remember you sending me the photo when he looked like a different human being.
Completely different human being. Yeah,
he's... And in the spring and at the ATS, he looked like he was back to, like, 2018 shape.
Yeah, and he's a little bigger than I think they would even like him to be, I would assume. And the problem with that is that he loses athleticism and he kind of just loses his delivery, gets really stiff. And that I think is the problem, is it's when he's not in great condition, when you're 6'6", you know, 200, and I don't know what he was listed at. Maybe you can take a look what they have him listed on the roster. I think he's listed at like 250, 260 on the roster. Like he was listed at 220 2 years ago. Or last year, I think, in Lowell. Actually, I know he was listed at 220 in Lowell last year. You know, and obviously we know that the heights and weights aren't wrong, but that they have him at 262 right now is a little concerning.
They have him, 266, 262, which is not small.
That's not what you want to see. And, the problem is when he's that size, it just didn't really work. And his velocity was down. You know, he was more like 88 to 94 at the top, but it was mostly like around 90, so 90, 91 with his fastball. And that was something when Groom's healthy, he's 92 to 94, up to 94 to 96.
Yeah.
So we're talking a full grade plus on the fastball velocity. The command is still not back. His curveball, which, I mean, I've seen it at its best pre-injury. I saw his best outing, which was that spring training outing, the final one for his Tommy John.
Yep.
That was like a 70 curveball.
Yeah.
And talking to scouts at the who saw him at Instructs, and it's more like an average curveball now, maybe a 55 if you're generous. And so that's a far cry from what it was before. And if he doesn't have that weapon pitch, he doesn't really have a third pitch still. His changeup is below average, fringy. He started throwing a slider at Instructs, which I was told it's not a difference maker. You know, it's fine, but it's inconsistent. It's more of a fringe average pitch too.
As you would expect for a pitch he's just starting to throw,
Exactly. Yeah, but that's something I'm not going to write off yet, but just based on that look, it wasn't great. And, you know, if you're talking about a guy with a couple average pitches, maybe a 55 pitch and then a couple fringe average pitches, you know, that's like a fringy MLB starter up and down type. That's not even a back end starter projection. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you compare with someone like Chris Murphy, we just described, that's more or less similar pitch mix to what Murphy's working with. But Murphy, I would say, has, you know, a better command profile. He's more athletic. So it's just what Groom now, it's tough. I don't know what to do with him because pre-injury Groom is a top, you know, eight, top seven prospect in the system.
Oh, higher.
Maybe higher a top five prospects in the system, but he's just never been healthy. And the stuff is regressing. The body's regressing. The delivery's regressing. Like, everything is trending the wrong way, which is just, it's not what you want to see.
Right. Yeah, it's like, how much do you want to ding him for Fall Instructional League?
And that's the hard part is, you know, I understand when the guys who go and have to file their reports based on Instructs, that's all they have to go off of. And obviously if they're going to have a negative report, it's understandable because that's all they're seeing, but it's hard, you know, when we've seen him good also, you know, how do we balance? Because it's just such a weird year this year. So he's someone who I think is probably close to the top of the list of guys we're going to need to see next year to have a better idea of what to do with him, because the clock's going to start as soon as he's added to the Rule 5 or added to the 40-man roster. You know, they have 3 years to kind of figure him out. And he's still not pitched above Greenville. And he's pitched what? Last time he pitched in Greenville was 2017, and he threw 40 innings.
Right.
He is so far behind the developmental curve that it's just unclear what, I don't know what, how they're going to make up for this and what's
I mean, pitching at the alternate training site this year probably counts for pitching in like Salem.
I agree. To some degree. But
it's also like he also might go back to Salem next year.
But he also threw like,
or
what,
I should say 30, high A.
30 innings there, 40 innings there.
Yeah.
You know, we needed to see him go out there and throw 100, 120 innings in a season. Right. And he still has not shown he can do that. And with the high risk body that he has, you know, that's the kind of frame that injuries are going to happen. Muscle injuries are going to happen. So, yeah, it's going to be – he's someone I'm interested to see next year. And he's probably going to get pushed down a little bit in the rankings. But it's just – it's so much unknown with him.
How about one of the new guys, Jason Rosario? Maybe not quite along those lines, but certainly a guy who, you know, we were intrigued about getting new reports on, and not really awe-inspiring.
Yeah, Rosario was fine. He got off to a good start, but kind of as camp went on, he struggled. And I think the thing that stood out is Rosario just doesn't have a carrying tool. You know, it's a bunch of kind of meh tools. His frame is not
talked about him in the Rule 5 thing, though. His frame's
not that projectable. He's good on defense, but I'm not sure he can hit. He didn't hit very well at Instructs. Doesn't really impact the ball. So, yeah, it's just kind of – I mean, he was fine, but it wasn't – you'd expect someone who's played in high A and had a full season's worth of at-bats there to do better against a lot of pitching he was facing, which is never even – a lot of it had frankly never pitched above, like, the complex leagues.
All right, and then maybe, just to kind of wrap up this category, how about the two infielders the Red Sox drafted in the second round in 2019 in Cameron Cannon and Matthew Lugo?
Yeah, both of them were a little disappointing. Lugo – I think the thing that's a little was not ideal to hear is that it seems like he's regressed a little bit athletically. He's not as fast as he was. And the scouts I talked to weren't sold. He's a shortstop. You know, the arm is 50-55. It's a good arm. He can hit a little bit, but I just don't know if there's that much. There's much upside as I thought, because there doesn't seem like the frame is as projectable as it should be. And the athleticism decreasing, if he has to move off shortstop, it obviously puts a lot more pressure on the bat. I wouldn't write him off or anything. And, you know, he had some good days at Instructs. He also had some bad days. But I think it's more that there are other guys in the infield, like Nick York, Brainerd Bonacci, who have passed him in terms of their upside. And then, the other one is Cameron Cannon. And Cannon struggled again. He obviously really struggled with Lowell last year. Part of that could have been attributed to kind of some changes with his swing, which the Red Sox, we found out after the season, but there was not a lot of good things happening for him. And that's definitely concerning, because this is now, you know, two seasons in a row, more or less, that the reports were not good. So he's someone who really we're going to need to see next year to kind of see what the deal is there.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, you know, we talked about the swing changes for Cannon, but like the swing changes weren't why he swung at first pitches and 18 consecutive at-bats, right?
They didn't explain what was going on. It was very weird, and it's definitely concerning to me.
Yeah.
I'll just say I'm more concerned about Cannon than I am Lugo.
Right. Fair. All right. And then maybe a couple of final groupings. Let's talk about some international guys that we hadn't really seen stateside yet. One that was kind of interesting with the reports compared to what we heard about coming into camp was Chijung Liu. Definitely seemed like a different pitcher based on what we were reading.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And I look back and I realized that Liu, like, his pitching history is really weird. He took that year off.
To rest his arm. I think it was 2 years. He took two years off.
He's never started, really. He's only pitched in relief, more or less. And he showed really well at, like, one international showcase where he was in the mid to high 90s. But his velocity was not close to that. Like, he was mostly 88 to 91, 88 to 90. I think he topped out at 93. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a bunch of fringy pitches. You know, it was like a changeup, splitter, some breaking balls. You know, he threw a bunch of different pitches. None of them were that good. And yeah, it was, I know people just were not that impressed with him.
Keep in mind, he was reportedly sitting 93 to 96 and topping out at 97, 98. So getting this from that guy is so disappointing.
And this was like multiple appearances.
And he's not that young. He's going to be 21 now.
Yeah, so he it was 89 to 92, top 93, 88 to 91. Like, it was all in that range, slider, changeup, maybe a splitter also, command iffy, has some feel, but there's a lot of development needed. And it was just a far cry kind of from what we heard he was coming out of Taiwan.
And then how about some of the Dominican Summer League guys, Ian? There was that grouping of outfielders that we've talked about, in our positional reviews. Of guys that had come over, maybe a couple of the highlights there in kind of a lightning round fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a bunch of they had a bunch of those outfield types, and the one I got that stood out the most from the guy from the people I'm talking to was Eduardo Lopez. He's got a really good approach, which we understood. You know, he had a 15% walk rate in the DSL last year, and it wasn't a fake 15% walk rate. He really showed that he knows what he's doing at the plate. Other than that, it's a bunch of average-ish tools, but you really like that walk rate. You like the contact ability and the polish, and he's someone who I think that he got stronger as the camp went on, which I like to see, facing against more advanced pitching, frankly, than he is for the most part. So definitely someone I'm interested to see next year. Another one who was really was impressive was Darryl Bellin. He was actually playing first base, which I think is partially because they just didn't have any first basemen.
Yeah, I mean, basically they had two in camp, and one of them was Castellanos, who wasn't playing over there.
Yeah, so like they had Bellin and Roldani Baldwin also was playing first base. Bellin is huge. He's like 6'4". I don't know what he's listed at weight-wise, but he's a very, very big human. And he's got big raw power. The contact is a question mark, and he's not very fast, but he's 6'4", got some feel.
6'4", 204 on the roster.
He's got some feel at the plate, and the power is legit. Like, he hit an absolute tank one of the days off of Jay Groom. And his nickname, which I enjoyed, is El Animal, which I just, for some reason, made me laugh that his nickname is the animal. But he was good. Scouts liked him. The other guys, Eduardo Vaughn, Juan Chacon, Brian Gonzalez, all of them had some ups and downs. You know, they had some areas where they were pretty good, other areas where they struggled. And all these guys, they were kind of grouped together. It was really – Bonacci was the clear top of that group. And right. Then Lopez was the top of the outfielders, followed by Bellin, and then Vaughn, Chacon, Gonzalez kind of in that same boat together. Gonzalez is big raw power, but question marks about his ability to make contact. Vaughn is projectable, but it's really raw. And Chacon does some things well, but there might not – it's not a standout tool yet. And he's super young.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And maybe let's talk about the draftees and non-drafted free agents from this year. Kind of skipped Nick York and Blaze Jordan, who we'd thrown into those previous categories. Where would you put them and what the reports on them were?
Yeah, so of the draftees, Nick York was the most impressive, and it wasn't really close. York can hit. That's the thing. He's from what I was told, he is not good at defense. Like, mm-hmm. He's a second baseman for sure, and that might even be pushing it, which is a little concerning because puts a ton of pressure on the bat.
Sure.
But he can hit, and he kind of seemed to he was really strong out of the gates, but as camp went along, he kind of got a little worse and started struggling to pull the ball a little bit. So that's something he'll have to work on, obviously. And the injury concerns, obviously, with him, he does have a pretty lengthy injury background, which is something we're gonna have to watch, but he was solid in his pro debut. Blaze Jordan was kind of as advertised. You know, he has a bunch of power, not sure how he's going to handle velocity was what I was told, and probably a first baseman. So, you know, it's kind of a wait and see with him. You know, it's the type of profile that sometimes you're going to hit, you're going to turn into guys like, you know, CJ Crone, maybe even Bobby Dalbec, hopefully one day. And other times it's not going to work out. You know, it's kind of a volatile profile, and it's just which end of the spectrum is he going to end up on. A lot of that's going to depend on how his hit tool develops. Jeremy Wu Yelland, and then Blaze Jordan was probably the second most impressive. And then right after him, or probably might have been a little more impressive than him, was Shane Drohan, the lefty who was their fifth round pick out of Florida State. Drohan is just a projectable athletic guy. You know, right now his raw stuff's not there yet. He's, you know, 89 to 92 with some average to maybe a tick above secondaries, but he just has some feel. The delivery works. He's a good athlete. He's the kind of guy you like to see because there might be more there as they get him into the development system. Jeremy Wu Yellen, and he has the chance to be a starter, which is good to hear. Jeremy Wu Yellen, on the other hand, is a straight reliever, 93 to 97 from the left side. Command's going to be an issue. He walked a ton of guys there. It's kind of just like arm strength and maybe a little breaking ball, but there's a long way to go developmentally with him. And then kind of to wrap it up, the two undrafted free agents who were there and pitched were Brian Van Bell and Jordan DiValerio. And Van Bell is someone who I think is might get consideration in the back end of the top 60 just because his changeup is really good. You can see it. He posted video, I believe, on his. It's a very good changeup. It's a plus changeup, 55, 60 changeup. And velocity, you know, it's like 89, 93. But if he's commanding the fastball and with that kind of changeup, he's someone who can stick around for a while and probably get to the high minors pretty quickly. So he's pretty interesting. And then DiValerio is just like a solid org guy, three, four pitch mix, throw strikes. But he was facing really young hitters, and he kind of took advantage of that because he knows how to pitch. But not a lot of upside there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Van Bell that's so hard with him is he's already 24.
Yeah, he'll be, what, 25 by the time next season starts, too?
No, he'll be 24 next season.
Oh, okay.
Like his birthday is he's a September birthday.
Yeah,
so he'll be 24 all of next
very
season.
Very old, yeah.
For a guy who hasn't pitched yet, like, you know, when we talk about our 2021 projections page, like, he's in Salem, and I should say high A. Not that we know anything, I'm just saying who knows. He's in high A, and my inclination is like, oh, maybe they start him in Greenville, and it's like, you realize he's got like 4 years on we're putting in that rotation.
I forgot that he was a redshirt senior in college, so he did 5 years at Miami. So
he was a JUCO guy.
Oh, was he? Okay, that makes sense.
He was a 3 year JUCO guy and then went to Miami for 2 years.
For 2 years, that makes sense.
Yeah,
but anyway, yeah, he was interesting and scouts did like him.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that's gonna wrap up the Fall Instructional League, guys. If you guys have any questions, again, it's podcast@soxprospects.com. And that's probably a good transition into this week's round of emails, Ian. We've only got a few.
Quickly mention, though, that we have reports on everyone else that played that we didn't mention, and those will just probably end up on the news page or Twitter. So just make sure to follow the news page, follow me on Twitter and the website on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And that's where the info on the rest of the guys and more tidbits will be put up over the next couple of weeks.
Great, great point, Ian. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, again, it's news.soxprospects.com. Make sure you're checking that out. And again, emails podcast@soxprospects.com. If you've got questions, comments, concerns, thoughts, anything that you think would add to the show, anything that you want to know about, anything you want us to discuss, hit us up. And our first email, I'm not going to say the name yet, Ian, because it's part of the email, but it's actually, let me get to the PS. He says, it's Mad Dog, not my dog. LOL. I got tired of the name being constantly butchered. Sorry. So it's Mad Dog 561, who only used 1D. I know that's probably extremely disappointing to you, Ian. But he asks, hey, guys, is there any chance that the Red Sox sign someone like a Kevin Pillar on a one-year type deal if they miss out on one of the big free agents so that they can have them split time with Jaron Duran so that he doesn't get all the pressure put on him all at once? Thanks for the email, Mad Dog. And I think some of the underlying premise there I don't agree with. They're going to sign a center fielder who will be an outfielder, because I guess in theory you could put Verdugo in center, Ian, but they're going to sign a starting outfielder. I think it's most likely going to be Jackie Bradley coming back on a 1 or 2 year deal, but there's no chance they go into next year with Jaron Duran unless there's an injury as a starting outfielder in Boston.
Yeah, I don't see any way Jaron Duran breaks camp with the big league club.
Yeah,
so
if they signed a Pillar, it would be to start.
Or to be a platoon partner with Bradley or something like they did this year.
Oh, like, sure, sure. Yeah.
Could see Pillar coming back, but it wouldn't be to platoon with Duran.
No. Yeah, that's fair. I could see Pillar coming back, too, because they do need a left-handed hitting bench, although Pillar is a righty. But they need a left-hander on the bench, which is why the Pillar fit isn't great for me.
Well, no, but I mean, if they sign Bradley, they'll want a right-handed backup outfielder because their entire outfield.
Right, but I'm saying their bench right now is extremely right-handed. So that's kind of where the left-handed hitting bench guy fits best. I don't know. We'll see. But a fair point. But yeah.
But the point is that you can't focus on the bench if you don't have a starting center fielder.
Good point. Very good point.
So I wouldn't worry about the bench now. You got to find a starter first.
Yep. Good point. Next question comes from Mark. He says, I read about how Seth Blair created a pitcher's mecca in Arizona to help himself and ended up helping a lot of other young guys stay strong this season. I heard it helped him reach another level. What's the buzz on him? Ian, we talked about Seth Blair a little bit on the last episode as a minor league free agent who re-signed. And in fact, we got this email before that episode came out, but Blair was a guy who really kind of remade himself dropped his arm slot to where I would call it maybe somewhere between low three quarters and sidearm. I don't think he's true sidearm. Mm-hmm. But you know, he remade himself. It's a potential middle reliever. I don't think that is something to get super excited about.
He was in the high 90s at the alternate site.
He was in the high 90s?
But yeah, he was like 96 or 97, 98. Varies his arm slot, throws hard, decent little slot breaking ball. Like, he's an interesting, you know, project, but I think he's 31 already too. So we're not talking about, you know, much of a upside or anything here.
Sure, sure.
Cool story, though. I hope he makes the big leagues.
Oh, it's super cool. Yeah, because he basically didn't play for like 4 years or something, and it was basically because of like a really bad divorce or something with like a child support, like a child custody situation. I'm only saying this because I read about it. I don't have inside information, but I'm saying it was a very weird situation where he basically like didn't play for a number of years. All right. And then our final question comes from Forrest. He says, "Hey guys, this is Forrest from Vermont. Thanks for all the work you do between the website and the podcast. There's no better way to be a more informed Sox fan." Thanks, Forrest. He says, "My question comes after the hiring of Kim Ng to be the GM of the Marlins," which, by the way, quick break from the email. Pretty awesome news bit, Ian, that we haven't talked about yet. Kim Ng becoming the first female to hold a general manager role with a major league team. She's been talked about for breaking
that. She's interviewed
a ton. She's been talked about as the person who would break that barrier for like 15 years.
She's way overqualified. So yeah, it's about time. It was a great hire by Miami.
Yep. He says, "Big congratulations to her. I was curious about her background, and while reading her Wikipedia page, I saw that she was one of four women to hold the title of assistant GM. And of those other three women, a name jumped out, Raquel Ferreira of the Boston Red Sox. How did I not know about her? Turns out she's been with the team for 22 years and in the front office for much of that. Apparently, a lot of her focus has been on player development. Is she someone you have been able to interview? I'd love to know more about her impact on the team. If you're ever traveling through Vermont in the summer, make sure to stop in Montpelier for a Mountaineers game." It's a college summer league. He says, "Thanks for your time. Shout out to Ian for being a Man City fan." Forrest. Great email, Forrest. Thank you. And I'm sure Ian agrees, given the Man City shout out. But Ian, Raquel Ferreira, someone who's been around for a while and who... It's kind of interesting where she has worked her way into now where she is an assistant GM who is like involved in multiple aspects of running the front office. But her role with the team for a long time was, and I'm not downplaying it by any stretch, but it wasn't necessarily an on-field role in terms of, you know, when we say she was involved in player dev, she wasn't involved in necessarily the coaching and the, you know, setting the programs for the players and stuff like that. Her job was more, I'm trying to make this sound like she was some kind of secretary, because she wasn't. It was kind of a functional role of like making sure all the visas were lined up, making sure the players get into camp. If there's any kind of issue that pops up, she's the fixer, helping players get from one affiliate to another if they get promoted. She was like the person you called if something needed to get done, basically.
Yeah, she really. It seemed like she connected with the players really well.
And that's. Go ahead. I think you're probably about to go where I'm going, but that's.
No, you can go.
That's kind of turned itself into now where she has ingratiated herself so much with the players as they came up. Apparently, she was instrumental in helping to negotiate the Xander Bogaerts extension because she had that line to him and his trust, such that, you know, she was able to talk to him, find out what he wanted, what was important, and help him, you know. Help get him, you know, willing to sign that, not get him willing to sign that contract, but, you know, help with the negotiations and those discussions. She's now, you know, I mean, they're basically the Red Sox front office brain trust. Obviously, it's Chaim Bloom in the CBO position with Brian O'Halloran as the GM. But then you have that kind of the group of kind of top front office brass behind him. It's Eddie Romero. It's Raquel Ferreira. And it's I think Zach Scott is the third guy. In that kind of next tier behind BOH.
Well, which makes sense. And Ben Crockett also, he might not be in that tier.
Well, he's not one of the assistant GMs, I don't think.
But I kind of look at it, Ferreira is kind of like the player development. Like, she oversees a lot of that. Zach Scott's the analytics side, obviously, and Eddie Romero's the international side. So they have a really good, like, mix of they all complement each other really well, I would say.
Yeah, so it's if you're looking, Raquel Ferreira is an EVP, assistant general manager, as is Eddie Romero and Zach Scott. The three of them hold that executive vice president slash assistant general manager position.
Yeah.
Whereas then if you take the next step down, that's when you get to guys who like, let's see here, vice president of player development, Ben Crockett.
Right.
Vice president of professional scouting is Gus Quattlebaum. Vice president of scouting is Mike Rickard.
Yeah.
And that's kind of that next sort of tier of vice presidents
that makes sense
that you have.
Yeah. So I kind of think that I think one day she definitely will get consideration for a GM job, and she should, because, you know, the things she does or has been credited with doing and still continues to do for the organization are invaluable. Every organization has people who do that. Yeah, I mean, she definitely, I think, someday will get consideration for it.
Yep, for sure. For sure, yeah. But she's definitely a name to watch. And I think, you know, with Kim Eng kind of breaking that barrier, it kind of paves the way. And just
hopefully
the reaction.
Hopefully she's the first of many.
Yeah, and the reaction on Twitter, you know, let's face it, Twitter kind of sucks sometimes, slash a lot. And that's before, you know, we get to Fleets, which debuted today. But, you know, the response to Kim Eng getting the Marlins job was universally great. And just some of the stories you saw of, like, I think it was Mark Carrig, who's like, I'm the father of a, you know, Asian female, you know, an Asian daughter who looked up who when she saw that Kim Eng got that job, said, wait, so I can get that job? And that's cool.
Yeah, that's the cool thing is, you want to, baseball is in a position where they need to be opening as many doors as possible and expanding the fan base and, you know, people who want to work in the game as much as possible to increase diversity of hirings. You know, for too long, it was a gentleman's sport made up of, let's be honest, a lot of white guys.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still a long way to go, but this is a really good step. And it's obviously, as you said, I think it's the first female general manager in any major professional sport in the U.S. And I believe
it's believed to be
the first Asian American general manager of any. I believe so.
Interesting.
At least in baseball for sure.
Yeah.
So it's just,
I don't know what sport there would
two
be
things that is she, I mean, she's been around the game forever. She's won a bunch of World Series. She's been with the Dodgers, the Yankees.
She's been with MLB for a while. Yeah. That's
she's
where
been
she came
MLB
from
for a while. Like, she's done everything. She's worn a ton of hats, started with the White Sox, obviously. And yeah, it's just cool to see someone like that rewarded, because, you know, she's been, her name has been floated out there for so many jobs over the years. I remember kind of as like, it was never clear if it was people were serious or it was more just, you know, throwing a name out there. But it's good to see that finally someone is recognizing her. Well, people have recognized for a long time, but you know what I mean? She's getting that chance to run a team her way.
For sure. For sure. So that's great. And thanks for the email, Forrest. I'm glad you mentioned it, because if Forrest had not enough, we would have gotten to it. And I'm glad we did.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yep. By the way, just as a quick wrap up, Ian, maybe something to close on. Theo Epstein left the Cubs today.
Yeah, that was wild. not entirely unsurprising, though.
No.
It also seemed like this was coming for a little bit.
It's a good time. It's good timing, because they're stepping back, they're retooling, and he kind of, you know, someone made the point, I forget who, it might have been Alex. I think it was Alex Speer. But if it wasn't, I apologize. But it's, you know, when he left the Red Sox, it was after 9 years, and it was, they're about to hire a new manager. It should be Ben Cherington's hire, which is kind of funny in hindsight, because I think that was the Bobby Valentine hire, which is most definitely not Ben Cherington's hire.
Yeah.
But he said it was a good time for him to move on, because they had an internal transition plan in place, and it was a good time to kind of make a switch. And that's kind of where the Cubs are at, where Jed Hoyer is obviously stepping up to take over as president.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what Jed can do, because obviously another guy who came from the Red Sox, who well-respected around the game, has interviewed for a ton of jobs. So it'll be cool to see him running his own team. And I don't think this is the last we've seen of Theo running a team. I don't know if he's going to, I mean, he said he's not going to he doesn't want to run a team this year, but
he said he's interested in like maybe more of a, like, you know, not politics, but maybe like, what did he say instead of politics? It was not politics, but maybe policy.
Yeah.
So maybe a non-baseball type thing. Or it sounds like, given the way he was talking about the game of baseball, like, I want MLB to hire him.
I would love for him to become the commissioner.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
He had some ideas about how to improve the game and is like going
get him
away.
In that office. Like,
yeah.
Oh.
But I think another thing that I wonder if played into it was kind of coming off the pandemic. The Cubs have obviously already laid off a ton of their front office personnel.
Sure.
If Gio knew he wasn't fully committed, he has by far the biggest salary.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what he said.
He's saving $10 million that can be redistributed to his, you know, his guys and gals in the front office. So
although
that's...
I did see a tweet from a Cubs guy I follow on Twitter that was like, you know, okay, good. The Ricketts can, that's $10 million the Ricketts can put into the Cubs instead of lining their own pockets or donating to political campaigns.
That's a fair point. But so... we don't talk politics on here.
Well, we don't, but I'm just saying it. The point is, you know, yeah, okay, teams are losing money, but it's not like, you know, owners or mom and pop
they're
shops
not...
here.
The owners are not the ones who are struggling right now. Let's just say that.
Right.
But yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I would assume that Steve Cohen is going to make and the Mets will make a play for him. I don't know if he'll. I
think
they will.
I don't, because like, if you're Theo Epstein, why would you go to the Mets to work underneath Sandy Alderson when you were running the show in Chicago? I just don't see the fit.
Well, but is it Sandy Alderson for sure there, or is he more of just like a figurehead to transition until they get someone permanent?
I mean, but they're not going to bring him in for a month.
I mean, maybe that he was just, I mean, I don't know. Huh. So I it'll be interesting to see where he ends up next, though.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So
I honestly thought you were going to mention Will Venable, by the way. I thought.
Oh, gosh, Will Venable. Yes, the Red Sox.
I thought that's the big thing you were
no, 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 no. Another thing to close on. As we were about to record this, it got reported. I think Jared Karabas and Rob Bradford had it first. But Will Venable is going to be the new bench coach for Alex Cora. I love the hire. Really weird for me because he was playing at Princeton while I was at college, and I definitely wrote article. I covered the baseball team while I was at Brown, and they played Princeton, and I wrote about him.
He's probably really smart.
So yeah, I mean that's a little weird.
Better than Brown, right? Academically.
Yes.
Oh, I was actually.
They're both better. They're both better than Michigan.
I mean that's just patently false, but you can continue. Believing what you want to believe. Yeah, I think it's interesting though because he's interviewed for a ton of GM jobs recently, or not GM, sorry, manager jobs over the last two off seasons,
yes.
I believe. And didn't he interview for the Red Sox manager job?
Yeah, and he wasn't a finalist, which was weird.
No, but he was the third base coach for the Cubs last year, mm-hmm. After serving as the first base coach the last 2 years, and he kind of fits the mold of the guys you want in that position. You know, the bench coach seems like it's.
Right.
A lot of organizations are going the way of getting an ex-player who can really connect with the players, but is very like analytically inclined, things like that. He has front office experience, obviously, with the Cubs. So I like the hire, and I'm definitely interested to see how him and Cora get on.
Yeah, yeah, and you wonder how long he's planning to stick around, because I'm sure there are people saying, like, oh, it would have been nice to get Sam Fold for that spot. The problem with Sam Fold is he's, like, on the cusp of becoming a manager.
Yeah, whereas it seems like Venable is someone who might be able to get a couple of years out of, Fold is, yeah. And
yeah.
Fun fact, he has the most Major League Baseball career hits and home runs of any Princeton alumnus.
There you go. He's probably also the best Princeton – well, I shouldn't say one of the best Princeton basketball players to play baseball, but played basketball at Princeton.
Yeah, he's the second athlete ever to earn all Ivy League in both basketball and baseball.
There you go.
Baseball and basketball. I think I just said – yeah, whatever.
Basketball.
Anyway. Yeah, basketball, exactly. I think it's time to wrap up.
It is. All right, well, I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank Podcast Joe 2.0 for producing our show, and I want to thank the Ludlow Thieves for our intro and outro music, All the Money. You can catch that on Spotify, Tidal, Amazon Music, whatever it is you listen to music these days. Thank you to our patrons again, patreon.com/SoxProspects. If you want to support the show, and send us your emails. We want to talk about what you want to hear about. It's podcast@SoxProspects.com. The Twitter handles, make sure you're following the site @SoxProspects. Follow us. Ian is @IanCundall. That's IanCundall. Follow me @SPChrisHatfield on the Twitter machine. I'm not doing any fleets. Ian, you doing any fleets?
No, I don't understand it. I still haven't even...
Instagram stories, basically.
I know. I don't like that there's... It's taking up way too much room on my timeline,
yes,
at the top.
Agreed.
I really don't like it.
Agreed. If I want to go on Instagram, I'll go on Instagram.
Exactly. Well, I don't really like Instagram either, but I think that this will probably be the last. This will obviously be the last show before the 40 man. So probably the next time we talk will be right around just before the non-tender deadline, I would assume.
Probably, yeah, because next week's Thanksgiving. I'm sure we're taking that one off. I don't know if we're going to be able to cut an episode the week after. It'll be tough. I may or may not have in-laws in town.
Yeah, so we'll figure it out.
Keep your eye on
we'll
Twitter.
We'll be in your ears soon enough.
Sounds good. He signed us off. Take care, everybody.